Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Everyday Anarchism. My guest today is Roman Krznarek. Do I have that right?
You have that absolutely right. You said every letter without fear. That was perfect.
I'll let Roman introduce himself in a second. But first, I need to say what we're doing. So we're here to talk about Colin Ward. It's the centenary of his birth today. I do intend to release this on the centenary of his birth. So if you're listening to it and it's a brand new episode, it's been 100 years since the birth of the brilliant Colin Ward. And now I need to confess to my guest and all my listeners that until Roman emailed me about this, I hadn't read any of Colin Ward because I came up with this idea for a podcast, mostly working with Graeber and Kropotkin. And I was working on the podcast and I hadn't quite come up with a name. And I took Graeber's concept of everyday communism and decided to call it everyday anarchism and was all ready to go. And then I suddenly found, like, I don't know, days before I was going to publish the first episode, that Colin Ward had used this phrase, everyday anarchy. And I just thought, oh no, I can't read this man's work. I can't do it. What if it destroys what I've done? What if I'm just repeating what he has said? So I have been afraid of reading Colin Ward for the almost 3 years that this podcast, knowing that I should be reading him. And now that you've approached me about this, I read this book. Unfortunately, I've only read the one book, Anarchy in Action, and it is just fantastic. Yes, I think I was right to not read it because so much of the work that I did with confidence, it turns out I was just duplicating his work. Here, Roman, now I'll turn it over to you. Can you tell us briefly who you are, what you've been working on, how you knew Colin, and then we can go deeper.
Sure. So as you said, my name is Roman Krznarek. I'm a social philosopher based in Oxford, UK, not Oxford, Mississippi. And I've spent the last few decades writing books about the power of ideas to change society. So the last book I wrote was called The Good Ancestor, How to Think Long-Term in a Short-Term World, which is kind of about intergenerational justice. I wrote a book about empathy, about how it can be a tool for politics. And most recently, I've got a new book out called History for Tomorrow, Inspiration from the Past for the Future of Humanity, which looks at the last 1,000 years of human history and says, what can we learn from that to tackle 10 challenges facing society in the 21st century, urgent challenges, climate change risks, inequality, threats to democracy, risks from artificial intelligence and genetic engineering. So that's sort of roughly what I've been doing in recent years. But I used to actually be an academic, a political scientist many, many, many years ago, like 25, 30 years ago, but no longer. So I'm really an independent sort of writer. And I first came across Colin Ward's work in the late 1990s. In fact, during the time of the 1997 UK general election, I was so disappointed by the moderate nature of the new Labour manifesto, Tony Blair at that time, which didn't seem that much different from the right party, the Conservatives. And so I headed down to my local radical bookshop I was living in London at the time, in Camden Town. And I went to this place and I went and bought every single radical magazine and newsletter I could. And I read through them all. And there was this one I came across called Freedom, the name of the magazine, Freedom, which of course is the famous anarchist newspaper first started in the 1880s by Peter Kropotkin and Charlotte Wilson. And there I discovered a writer called Colin Ward, who was writing about things like allotments, community gardens. He was writing about musicians having underground bands playing and music festivals going on. He was writing about children playing in adventure playgrounds. He was writing about housing cooperatives, workers' cooperatives. He was writing about, as you say, everyday anarchism. You know, he always talked about anarchism as a theory of social organization. So, and at the time when I read that, it wasn't just the time of the UK general election. I was also at the time doing a PhD in a very quite traditional political science department in a UK university. And I was studying government. And I suddenly realized Colin Ward was an expert on non-government. And that's what I was missing. I wasn't recognizing that things like the history of squatting was part of the history of politics. The history of people organizing together in local, voluntary, non-hierarchical ways, very Kropotkin-esque, which is where Colin Ward's very much coming from, that was actually a form of politics because it was about, as we know, the classic anarchist idea of finding autonomy and solidarity and finding it in those everyday relationships, in the revolution of human relationships, let's say. So I got absolutely hooked on Colin Ward, and I managed to get to meet him about a year or two after that encounter in 1997, became great friends with him and his wife, Harriet. And then Colin died, of course, in 2010. But as you say, this is the 100th anniversary of his birth in 1924. And I'm delighted to celebrate his life.
Okay, there's already so many ways to go. Actually, I'm going to pull it back. Say again the name of your most recent book. I always forget the book titles.
It's called History for Tomorrow, Inspiration from the Past for the Future of Humanity.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say it's a book about saying we're trapped in the tyranny of the now, the tyranny of the present moment. You know, our politicians who can't see beyond the next election or the latest tweet, or they're giving us all this idea that technology can solve all our problems. You know, that's the AI algorithms and carbon capture and storage. And I really wanted to write a book about the lessons of history, but not the traditional way of looking at warnings from history, how we shouldn't repeat fascism and colonialism. And of course, there are important books on those topics, like Timothy Snyder, the great historian who's written his book on tyranny. But I thought, well, let's look at not just what went wrong, but what went right. When have human beings managed to organize collectively to tackle injustices, change their societies, deal with crises? And I've been very much influenced by Colin Ward, but we can maybe get back onto that.
Well, yeah, I just want to say, again, going back to this idea that the work that I'm doing, and I, you know, I got a lot of it from Graeber and a lot of it from Kropotkin, is very similar to the work that Colin was doing. Reading that book that you shared with me, I think any listener of this podcast will enjoy that book. And this, at least insofar as when the episodes that I've been doing lately have mostly focused on history, because I've been doing these two big series is okay, I guess that's plural, one on David Graeber's debt and one on the English Revolution, also known as the English Civil War. And it's been precisely to say that the history that we have is a sort of sparse history, an overly simplistic history. Really, in so many ways, as you say in your book, it is an imperialist history, not a history from below. So if you've enjoyed these episodes where we think about the different, I mean, someone just emailed me that said, Graham, the way that you treat the Middle Ages is something that was interesting and complicated and has lessons for our time, as opposed to just a Dark Ages that thank goodness we got out of. If you like that approach, and if you're listening to this podcast, I think you must. I just really recommend this new book by Roman. I found it so readable. And, you know, for example, the chapter on democracy that references Ocalan and Bookchin and Athenian democracy, I must admit, everything in that chapter, Roman, I think someone who's listened to every episode of this podcast, which, God, I doubt there's many who have listened to all of whatever, 130 episodes now, anyone who's listened to this podcast will have heard that stuff already. But for me, that stuff is all new in the past 5 years. And the other chapters that I haven't covered in my podcast, I learned really great, interesting stuff. So that's the kind of work that I am excited about. And I think my listeners will like it. So again, I'm recommending the book. And then I guess we can say, let's go back to Colin, but we can connect to this book. Like in what sense is that new book the result of your engagement with Colin Ward?
Well, I think it's really important to try and understand where Colin's work is coming from, you know, and, you know, his interest in everyday anarchism, all those things like the housing cooperatives and the workers' councils and community self-management of land and water. I mean, that came from, I think there were many influences on Colin. One of them was the great German anarchist Gustav Landauer. And he wrote a book about revolution in 1907. And there's this quote that Colin kept coming up with and quoting in many of his books. And it's this, and I'd just like to read it to you. He said, this is what Landauer, he said, "The state is not something which can be destroyed by a revolution, but is a condition, a certain relationship between human beings, a mode of human behavior. We destroy it by contracting other relationships, by behaving differently." And I think that is the core of how Colin saw the world. It was about how do we contract other kinds of relationships? And of course, I think this is a theme that's come up again and again in the podcast that you've done. And it's an idea, you know, that we know we can find in mutual aid and Kropotkin's work, and we can find it in other thinkers. But I think Gustav Landauer expressed it perfectly for Colin. And I think another, just to sort of put in place again where Colin's coming from, I think another really important influence on him, and you have to remember, he wrote more than 30 books. I mean, he was unbelievably prolific. He wrote Anarchy in Action, which you've read. He wrote a book called The Child in the City in the late 1970s, which has changed the whole field of child studies. He wrote a book called Arcadia for All about people building their own homes in little plot land settlements. He wrote a history of housing called Cotters and Squatters. He wrote on the British holiday camps. I mean, you know, sometimes people say Goethe was the last person who knew everything. Well, I think it was Colin Ward, actually, who also had a photographic memory, by the way. But I think one other really important influence on Colin Ward, and there are many, apart from, you know, Kropotkin and Gustav Landauer, was the Jewish theologian and philosopher Martin Buber. And, you know, some of people listening may know Buber's books like I and Thou, quite a sort of a philosophical anthropology, one might call it. But he also wrote a book called Paths in Utopia in the late 1940s, where he looked at figures like Kropotkin and Landauer, the anarchist tradition. And I think he was very influenced on that. He liked the kibbutz movement. He liked cooperatives. On a theoretical level, let's say, he had this idea of that society, you have to think of society in terms of there being a social principle and a political principle. The political principle is the hierarchical organization of politics and parties and elections and so on. The social principle are things like the cooperatives, the self-managed gardens and water systems and all those other things, the everyday anarchism. And he said that the way you change a society, like Landauer, is you try and expand the social principle, and that kind of drains power away from the political principle. And I think that's fundamental for Colin. And that's something that I started thinking about a lot after having gone through the mill of academic political science, thinking that the way you change a society is through laws and institutions and public policy. And Colin really helped open my eyes to the fact that there was another way, that social principle Buber talked about was actually a form of political action.
Yeah, that's absolutely crucial. I mean, this book, again, it's the shock of recognition in this book for me, or of re-recognition, is that when I read Anarchy in Action, I found so many examples that I had already cited in this podcast that I, you know, some of the examples come from Kropotkin or Bookchin or O'Shallan. Other were things that I, you know, I had found on my own, or I thought I had found on my own. Perhaps the people I found them in had gotten them from Colin Ward. And then many other examples, of course, that were new to me. So the basic idea of this book, I mean, another way of putting it is I was reading this book at the pool. So it's the summer. Everyone knows I have small kids, and also that I'm teaching. So right now I'm teaching classes asynchronously, meaning I don't have Zoom meetings. I just put assignments up for the students. And so I do a lot of work at the pool, and there's other dads around, including other professors. And so we were both reading our books. I put my work away and was reading Anarchy in Action. And this professor at Elon University, which is not far from where I am, was reading his book called, I think, Intersectional Environmentalism. But when he saw my book, he said, "Oh, are you planning something?" And it took me a second to realize what he meant. But he meant, you know, am I planning on bombing something? You know, because it's got the word anarchy in it. And this is, you know, this is a left wing academic who just sees the word anarchy and thinks, "Oh, you know, Graham is out to blow something up." And this point, the heart of this podcast, Everyday Anarchism, comes from this point made by many people, but especially by Colin Ward, among others, that anarchism is this set of social relations. And wherever you look, I mean, Graeber makes this point even more strongly. If things are working, they are working because of anarchism. And whatever the system is that the political scientists analyze and claim that is the thing that is driving society, it's probably systems that are working are probably working in spite of those top-down hierarchical arrangements, not because of them.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And of course, you can look in the classic anarchist literature, and in Kropotkin, for example, and see revolutionary tendencies, which, you know, link to that cliched idea of the anarchist as those sort of bomb, throwing a bomb, trying to blow up a Tsar. But there's also this other tradition, of course, of, you know, the everyday anarchism. The, you know, Colin Ward used to say that an anarchist society was like a seed beneath the snow.
Yes.
And that's on the first page of Anarchy in Action. And I think it's beautiful. And I think it's powerful, too, because it makes us realize that anarchism is not something strange. It is very everyday. You see it in the playground with the kids at the pool, maybe, that you see. Yes. In fact, Colin Ward was very interested in the history of swimming and the history of swimming pools, public spaces like that, and how they function. And so I think, again, you can see that Colin was the kind of, you know, I always think Colin had a kind of an X-ray vision, that once you start looking for those everyday Kropotkin-esque, non-hierarchical, cool local voluntary mutual aid relationships, you start seeing them everywhere, right? You see them in your community garden. You see them in the school playground. You see them in the housing co-op. And it sometimes reminds me a bit of the great Nobel Prize winning economist Elinor Ostrom, who theorized the idea of the commons. She had a kind of X-ray vision too, where she could see the commons. She could see by sort of looking at all, whether it's lobster fishermen in Maine or you know, people managing forests in Switzerland, that they were self-managing through a set of agreed rules to overcome the tragedy of the commons. And I think Colin Ward was doing something very much like that. And I find it a bit like you, kind of looking through the podcast or the things you read, and suddenly you see it all in Colin Ward's books. I keep finding him sneaking into my brain or into my book. So just leafing through my new book, History for Tomorrow, several of the core examples in that book, I realized I discovered in Colin Ward. So let me just give you one example. So in Valencia, in the east coast of Spain, there is this incredible ritual that happens every Thursday at 12 o'clock outside the west door of the cathedral. A group of black cloaked figures, nine of them, they sit down and they have a meeting. And this is the Tribunal of Waters, the Tribunal de las Aguas. And these are locally elected representatives of the irrigation canals, which, you know, provide water for Valencia's rich agricultural region. You know, it's famous for its Valencia oranges and so on. And so they're elected by local farmers, and they issue fines to farmers who have taken more water than their fair share or not looked after their irrigation canal. And it is one of the oldest democratic legal institutions in Europe. It's been going for hundreds of years, meeting in the same spot. In fact, it goes back to before the reconquest of Spain by Christians over the Islamic society, you know, before in the 13th century. So it's very, very old. It's kind of like living history. And it's a great example of commoning and I think a model we should look at for how we think about controlling resources democratically and locally. But where did I first find that example? I found it in Colin Ward's book, Reflected in Water, A Crisis of Social Responsibility, a book he wrote in 1997 about the global water crisis. And many of these kinds of examples I found, you know, like the stuff you mentioned in the democracy chapter of my book. You know, there's stuff on modern things about Rojava, which of course Colin didn't write about, you know, and that's very much connected with Murray Bookchin. But Bookchin himself was writing, you know, drawing on historical examples like communal democracy in Switzerland in the late medieval period, which Colin Ward was also writing about. And in fact, Colin introduced Bookchin to British readers in the 1960s through a journal called Anarchy. Because Colin, you know, born in 1924, he came of age as an anarchist in the late 1940s, really. He started editing and contributing to the newspaper Freedom. And then in the 60s, he edited this journal called Anarchy, which introduced not just Murray Bookchin, but people like Paul Goodman to British audiences and gave a voice to other radical English thinkers like Stan Cohen and Carol Pateman. So Colin was a kind of an intellectual ambassador of everyday anarchism.
Yeah, I think one place I want to go now is we're thinking of – first, I should say that I did not read your entire book, but I did read the water chapter as well. It's so fascinating how these things are resonating. And, of course, if you live in the United States, especially anywhere in the Western United States, which I don't, but the water – the question of water is – you know, the question of water was solved decades ago by the federal government. It declared how much water everyone was allowed to use. And that system has, you know, not worked for more or less a single day since then, because there's no democratic processes. There's not true accountability. It's a top-down system and it's not working. This is the kind of one of the things I hear all the time. I mean, this is just an obsessive refrain, or it's only obsessive for me because the other people are only saying it one time, but I hear it every time. When I tell everyone the basis of my ideas, they always say, well, who's going to be in charge and how are you going to solve, you know, the big problems? And it just seems to me that when you read Colin's book, you see the way that people are able to solve big problems together, insofar as their problems are connected to things that the community can control. And then when people can't solve the big problems in the community basis, it probably means the big problem is in some ways artificial. It's a big problem that was created by other big things. I mean, the most obvious example, if we think about something like climate change, it seems insoluble. And the question is, you know, how could we do something? You know, this problem was created by these giant corporations and these giant governments. Yes, it was created by those things. And that suggests that the problem is less global warming, but the fact that we let giant corporations and giant governments do whatever they wanted. The only way that we're going to get out of this, it seems to me, is some sort of democratic process. But I hear, and I've even heard from guests on my podcast, that we need a Hobbesian Leviathan to solve the global warming. I mean, go right ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I don't agree with that idea that we need a Hobbesian Leviathan, and I'm sure you don't either, or it comes down to some kind of benevolent dictator. You know, in fact, I did a study of this for my last book, The Good Ancestor, because I kept coming across people saying, you know, what we need are these benevolent dictators to sort things out for us. We need to be like Singapore or China. And I thought, well, I used to be a political scientist, as I mentioned earlier, and I thought, well, okay, let's have a look at that. Let's see what the evidence is. So I studied 122 countries and looked at the various sort of measures of policy success in environmental areas, inequality, social policy, education. And then I put them on a graph against with their long-term policy impacts on the x-axis and how democratic they were on the y-axis. And of course, it turns out that of the 25 highest scoring countries in terms of good quality public policy, 21 of them are democratic governments of some form. And of the 25 lowest scoring, 21 of them are authoritarian regimes. So that tells you something. But of course, all those democratic countries could be a hell of a lot more democratic. I mean, they're still very hierarchical. They're based on this ridiculous 18th century political system we call representative democracy, which was invented to not to give power to the demos, not to give power to the people, but to put it in the hands of expert elites. And, you know, as Rousseau famously said, you know, the English people, he said this in 1762, the English people believe themselves to be free, but they're only free when they have an election of members of parliament. And as soon as the members are elected, the people are enslaved. I mean, I think we've still got that system. But I think you're right that we can look to the kind of anarchist, everyday anarchist style solutions to those problems. But of course, as you say, because of the nature of some of the problems, like the climate crisis or the impacts of big tech, let's say, a Colin Ward style anarchism can't deal with Elon Musk, can't deal with the enclosure of biodata by the genetic engineering industry. It can't deal with ExxonMobil. So even though I think of myself as a kind of anarchist foundationalist, in the sense of I will go to anarchism as the starting point for thinking how we should be organizing our lives, our communities. And then if there's something that can't be solved on that level, let's try and delegate power upwards, ideally not to an oligarchic elite, you know, but certainly maybe towards some centralized institutions who are going to have to enact climate litigation to stop ExxonMobil pumping, you know, carbon into the sky.
So, I mean, actually, this is a good place to bring in the work of Kim Stanley Robinson, who you and I have talked about already. Now, you know, Stan insists that he is no anarchist. And if you look at, you know, last time I talked to him was about the Mars Trilogy. And at the time, I had not read the kind of appendix to the Mars Trilogy, which is called The Martians, which is we discussed it on this episode because the Mars Trilogy – The Martian starts off with this sort of alternate history where the whole Mars trilogy doesn't happen. I found it very upsetting and put the book down. And then he said on the podcast, like, I was trying to shock the reader. I was like, well, yeah, you got me. But after I talked to him, I went back and read it. And it includes the constitution for the new Martian Republic. And it's, you know, it's completely, I would say, an anarchist constitution. It calls attention over and over again to the Swiss concepts of democracy that you have discussed. The lower house of the legislature is, you know, elected, quote, elected by rote. It's like jury duty. There's all sorts of different sources of power. It's as anarchist as you can imagine, or as I can imagine, a widespread globe spanning system of government. So one option is to say, like, oh, well, that's not anarchism. We can't do everything via anarchism. At some point, we need some forms of organization that are bigger than that. I think that's probably what Stan would say. But I read these forms of organization and I say these are essentially anarchistic forms of organization. They are confederations of confederations. They are communes of communes. And I think you can do it, you know, all the way up and down with what I would call anarchism. If your definition of anarchism is, you know, there can't ever be a piece of paper document specifying the rules of the game and who does what, then sure, anarchy is out. But I have a more flexible, and some anarchists would say, you know, too flexible, the definition of anarchism that can be extended to those things, I think.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, certainly when I read the Mars Trilogy, I was seeing much more anarchism in there than one might imagine from someone like Stan, who defines himself as a democratic socialist, I think. And I think the Martian Constitution is a really good example, particularly that bit that you pulled out about how one of the houses, the lower house of the legislature, is basically based on what we now call sortition, which is random selection of citizens as we do for juries. And that's an old idea that goes back to ancient Greek democracy. But it's one, for example, that Murray Bookchin really celebrated in his writings, in his book, Urbanization Without Cities, I think it's called. I think it has a slightly different title in the US, but that's what it's called in the UK. And, you know, and he traced that through to those Swiss examples. And of course, Stan himself, I think, used to live in Switzerland, and I imagine was quite influenced by that direct democratic tradition. And one of the things I write about in my new book, History for Tomorrow, is this incredible republic called the Republic of the Three Leagues, or the Rhaetian Free State, which I had never heard of until a few years ago. Like back in the 1990s, I used to teach democratic theory and practice in UK universities. I used to think I was an expert on democracy. Like I used to write articles about democracy. I'd never heard of this thing. And now the Republic of the Three Leagues, or the Rhaetian Free State, began in the 1520s. And basically it was a renegade republic in what's now Switzerland, which was organized on anarchist principles. It was based on a number of neighborhood assemblies, about 250 of them, who would make decisions on their local issues, local tax, whether they should repair the alpine paths and so on. And then for the decisions that they needed to make at a higher level around defense or foreign policy, they would send delegates, not elected representatives, delegates, who are more like kind of ambassadors of their own group, who would report back. They'd send those up to a commune level, and some of them would then send up representatives to a Bundestag, a federal assembly that would just meet a couple of times a year when required. And this is an exact example of what Bookchin sometimes called libertarian municipalism, or I think of as democratic communalism, or Öcalan, in the great Kurdish thinker, also called it this. And so there are all these traces through, and you see them there in Kim Stanley Robinson. And I think also if you turn to other books of his, like New York 2140, you know, which is about, okay, Manhattan's basically half underwater. And what you see there is not a utopian anarchist society by any means, but what you see are elements of cooperative living in big buildings where people from different social backgrounds are communally eating together. I mean, it smacks of anarchism. Alongside that is property speculation by new forms of capitalism and so on. And I think that's what's powerful about his books, is that it's a kind of a bricolage, not just in terms of literary style, but also in terms of political theory and realism about, I think, what a future society might end up looking like over the next couple of centuries. His books, I love them because they're kind of messy in that sense of the political outcomes. Nothing is clear cut, neither the characters nor the social and political institutions in which they're embedded. I mean, would you agree with that?
Yes, I would. I mean, I think I said this to Stan last time we spoke about the Mars trilogy, is I kept waiting for the revolutions to happen in the Mars trilogy. And then I realized they were happening. I mean, what it just seemed like was just chaos, and characters were running around and being scared, and people were dying and bombs were going off. And I thought, when is the revolution coming? And then I realized, oh, this chaos and running and fear and violence, and then recovery from that intense period of violence and chaos, that was the revolution. But I'm used to reading about revolutions, you know, from the God's eye view, that something like, you know, in 1789, this happened and this was the result. And Stan's books are written, you know, I feel like what it would be like to have lived through these periods, and they are messy in that wonderful way. With respect to New York, what is it? 2140. Yeah, 2312 is the other one. That book is, Stan and I are planning on doing an episode on that book, but if you're, I wouldn't get too excited, listeners, because I think 2026 is our current plan for it. You know, getting on Stan's calendar is a lot of work. He's quite a busy man. I want to move to a couple of, there's two topics that came up in Anarchy in Action that are very important to me, one professionally, one personally. Let me go with the personal one first, which is, you know, he writes about children. Colin writes about children a lot. I haven't read the book, The Child in the City, but I just have to say, you know, when you are raising kids in, you know, the 21st century in the progressive space that I am raising kids, I mean, it just seems like anxiety is the name of the game. We're constantly afraid that our kids are not doing this and not doing that, and the test scores are too low and all these things. I mean, I try and resist these personally, but when the parents get together, this is the topic of conversation. I have over the past, my oldest child will have just turned 8 a couple weeks before this episode comes out. I've lived in a climate of fear or anxiety this entire time. And it's a very simple fear. It has nothing to do with test scores or anything. It is the fear that my child will be run over on the road of the residential street. I mean, we live in a leafy neighborhood in an elite town. And nevertheless, kids aren't really supposed to be outside playing. That's just, they're not supposed to be. I mean, they're allowed to be outside playing, I guess, but the road is right there. It is not designed for children to be on. Most people who pass through the neighborhood live in this neighborhood, but they drive too fast anyway. I think finally my youngest is at the point where he will not wander into the street and get hit by a car. But that has been maybe the driving fact of my parenting for as long as I have been a parent, that if I'm outside and I take my eyes off my child, they might get hit and killed. And I just have accepted that. That's one of the rules of parenting in the 21st century, at least in everywhere I've ever lived, that kids cannot go free because cars will hit and kill them. And Colin says, if that's the case, that means that the cities are not designed for the people, because to be designed for the people, they need to be designed for everyone. And children are people and should be allowed to use their city. Now, this seems common sense and obvious, but reading that was a revelation. Like, my God, there is something horrifically wrong that my children are at risk at death every time they are in their front yard. But I just accepted it. That's what it means to be a parent.
Yeah, I think that's brilliantly put. And I think if you look at Colin's influence on the world, I think one of his major influences is kind of making anarchism respectable in that everyday sense that we've already talked about. But I think one of his other influences is impact on how we think about the lives of children. And he wrote that book you mentioned, The Child in the City, then another one on The Child in the Country. And they're kind of explorations of autonomy, really, how children, you know, have been industrialized since the 19th century in public education systems, and then thrust into an industrial world full of cars and roads and all these kinds of things, into basically forms of control and limits on their freedom. And I remember when I first read The Child in the City, and I think somewhere in that book, there is a map of that a child makes of their local neighborhood. And if I remember it rightly, and I might be making this up, this little map made by, let's say it's a 6 or 7 year old, it's got a couple of little roads in it, but the things that are really prominent are trees and hedges and things that they might hide behind when they're playing. Right? So it's all about the perspective of the other here being children, right? That it's not, of course, how we talk about the other now, but I think what Colin Ward really did, at least in the European context, and of course his influence is not nearly as significant, you know, in the US or in North America, so on. But he was being very influential in parts of Latin America, though, I have to say. But I think what he helped us see is that this is how it connects to the idea of empathy for me. Empathy in the sense of what psychologists sometimes call perspective-taking empathy. Because there's two kinds of empathy. There's like affective empathy, where you feel other people's feelings. So if I see a child in anguish and I feel too that anguish, that's affective empathy with an A. But the one I'm interested in is perspective taking empathy, where you try and see the perspective of the other, step into their shoes, into their skin. That's the kind of To Kill a Mockingbird empathy. But it's also that what Colin was trying to do in these books about children, the child's view. And then when you start seeing the city through the child's view, then things like cars and the fact that cars kill a million people a year are a form of madness. You know, what kind of society are we that organizes around that? And actually, just as a side note, Colin also, he was really interested in the history of the motor car. And he wrote a little kind of pamphlet, or made a radio show called Local Motors. And one of the things he was talking about was how people used to make their own cars right, in the 20s and 30s, and even before that. But then car making became a massive corporate enterprise. Yeah. So imagine a world where we actually did make our own cars. Probably there would be far fewer of them. And maybe the whole way we thought about the role of the car in society would be different. And just to add one final thing here, which is really fundamental to Colin's work, is the idea of the garden city and the great city planner, Ebenezer Howard, who was writing at the late 19th century, early 20th century, and he wrote this famous book about garden cities for tomorrow, which is that idea that our towns and cities should be places where we live and work and play, not dormitory towns, places where there's freedom for children, where we grow food, you know, all these kinds of things which sort of make sense to us today with urban farming and Kropotkin's idea of having factories in the fields and fields in the factories. That's what Ebenezer Howard was writing about. And Colin Ward was very interested in that, because Ebenezer Howard was basically a town planner. And Colin, his first real jobs after he left the army, after the Second World War, was working in architects' offices. And then he worked in the 1970s for something called the Town and Country Planning Commission or organization. I can't quite remember what it's called. And that was founded by Ebenezer Howard. And so, again, the child is coming back into the center through his interest in urban planning and city planning.
Yeah, I just want to mention this briefly, because my dissertation was on cities and city planning and literature in the Progressive Age. And the figures I liked the most were Ebenezer Howard, Lewis Mumford, and Patrick Geddes. And somehow I did not manage to realize that these – thinkers were influenced by anarchism. Well, I know how. I knew that anarchism was wrong and bad and not interesting. And every time it popped up, I sort of, you know, whatever, Graham, don't go down that road. The anarchists aren't interesting. So to have discovered that Colin Ward would have been incredibly invaluable to my research.
Completely. You know, he wrote a book called Influences, which there's a chapter on all the major thinkers that influence him, Kropotkin and Buber, but Patrick Geddes is there. Right, who I had never heard of, right, until I read about it through Colin Ward. And in a way, one of the best things about Colin Ward, and I just want to recommend him to your listeners, is as a way of discovering all these other writers and thinkers and unofficial histories, they're all there. And you know, I guess I've read over them in many, many times and not picked up on people like Patrick Geddes until many, many years later. But you know, just hearing what you're saying there, I think like Colin Ward also loved Lewis Mumford. And was very influenced by him. I mean, as you have been as well. And I just think these are wonderful traditions of kind of anarchist thinking, which isn't always described as anarchist, but let us reclaim it. Let's feel it doesn't have to be an anarchism with too many adjectives in front of it or described as something else. Let's just call it for what it is.
Yeah, there was a recent book about Comfort, Alex Comfort, the author of The Joy of Sex, who was another anarchist. And, you know, you can think of, I mean, Colin Ward says, and I think this is right, that the sexual revolution is essentially an anarchist revolution. I mean, the labor rights movement of 100 years ago is essentially an anarchist movement or driven in so many ways by the ideas of anarchism. And this is just the history of anarchism often leaves these out because they aren't anarchist enough, you know? And then the non-anarchists leave this out because they're too anarchist. And I'm looking for that messy thing in the middle. And Colin has been a great guide.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say, though, that I think it's worth having a bit of a critical edge when thinking about someone like Colin Ward, that I think you could accuse him. And, you know, he was a dear friend of mine. And I feel like he was my kind of unofficial mentor, unofficial British grandparent, because I'm Australian. But when I moved here, he was a kind of an intellectual and sort of rock for me. But, you know, I think you could accuse him of a kind of incrementalism and reformism, you know, that he wasn't interested particularly, for example, in radical protest movements who are confronting the state or confronting big capital. I mean, yes, he wrote a little bit about the Occupy kind of those kinds of movements or the anti-capitalist movements of the early part of this century, but it wasn't central to what he was writing about. So I think that's one of the areas where he's quite different from David Graeber, you know, who wrote that book, The Democracy Project. Colin Neville wrote a book like that. He did write about the spontaneous uprisings of the Spanish Revolution or in Prague in 1968, but those kind of movements, which were much more about confrontation with the state, they were not his thing, you know? So I think you could probably, not accuse is the wrong word, but just point out the fact that his anarchism was not intended to be a kind of a revolutionary challenge to power. It was more expanding that social principle I mentioned earlier from Martin Buber. And I think the other thing about Colin, one might say, in a sense, is that this is something one could level against all anarchist thinkers, really, which is, well, how do you solve those larger problems of inequality between the global north and the global south? What's an anarchist solution to that? Or what's an anarchist solution to, as I mentioned before, managing global AI and biotech? I'm not sure anarchism always offers great answers to those kinds of questions, but hey, what ideology can answer every single question? So let's not ask for perfect blueprints. I think there's a sort of a, again, like Kim Stanley Robinson is sort of messy in the what he depicts in the world. I think there's an element of that in Colin as well.
Yeah, I think that's all right. And I'm going to have to, you know, I'm going to have to not pick up the question of how anarchism could solve the problem of AI, at least not right now. I will say,
I think there are some solutions, actually. But anyway, go on. Sorry, don't let me interrupt you.
Well, I also probably sit probably closer to Colin Ward than Graeber in terms of a mass protest in a belief in the efficacy of mass protest. This is maybe getting a little off topic, but I'll just put this out here because I've been thinking about it a lot. So there has been protests, and they have not been mass protests. They've been relatively small protests on college campuses on the question of I'm not sure what we are calling it, the war, the disciplinary massacre that Israel is inflicting on Palestine. And these protests, I mean, the one at UNC was peaceful, sedate, pleasant. It was frankly probably not, you know, harsh enough. And the students were arrested and their occupation was demolished. And I couldn't figure out why the university did this for what seemed like such a small and harmless and frankly useless, but I guess symbolic act. And the answer I've received as I've asked a lot of people this question is there's nothing that the right wing loves more than to crack down on, you know, the kind of protesters who they think that the broader populace will not be sympathetic to. And I didn't know this, but apparently the right wing narrative of the 60s protests is the 60s protests are what led to the Thatcher Reagan neoliberal revolution. That once the students come out with their signs and their banners and the barricades, that's when the right wing wins. Now I haven't thought about this that much. I don't have an argument I want to make about this, but I just recently discovered this idea that the best thing that can happen for the right wing is for the left wing to protest. At least that's what a number of people on the right wing think. And I'm just putting this idea out as something that I need to think about.
Yeah, more. I mean, I don't agree with that. I think it's definitely worth thinking about and looking at the kind of evidence. I mean, I think if I think of what are the sort of foundational principles of how I think about the political world, one of them is anarchism. Another one is the idea of ecological economics and the idea that the economy is a subset of the planet. And that took me a long time to understand that through the work of Herman Daly and other great thinkers. Another principle is the ideas of intergenerational justice, which I think are not mainstream in political thinking. But another one is the idea of the power of disruptive movements, the mm-hmm. power of radical flank movements through history to create change, whether it is the slave rebellions of the 19th century, of suffragettes, and you know many other movements through history. And I think when it comes to Thatcher, Reagan, neoliberalism, maybe there are examples you might pinpoint where elites responded or used the protests, public protests, as a means to legitimize new kinds of systems. But I'd say something like the Thatcher-Reagan neoliberalism, of course, had its roots much earlier in the Mont Pelerin Society in the 1940s, the long seeding of radical right libertarian ideas, you know, by Hayek and Friedman and all these kinds of people. So there are other things to think about, but you know, all good for discussion.
Yeah, well, lest the listener think that I am against protest. I'm not against protest. Let's put it this way. You know, Graeber's very clear that there are protests that he considers valuable and useful, and protests that are useless or even counterproductive. And he tells a story, it might be in the Democracy Project, of how, you know, if you march with Lyndon Johnson's face on a poster that says like re-elect Lyndon Johnson, that's great. He loves it. It makes it all about him. It reinforces the power structure. If you march with Lyndon Johnson's face and you've, you know, put an X through it and it says, you know, kill Johnson, it's the same thing. It's great. He loves it. It reinforces the power structure. There are forms of protest and forms of these radical movements on the streets that are counterproductive. And there are forms, I agree with you, that have transformed the world in just utterly profound ways. And I am broadly for, no, I'm strenuously for protest. But thinking through what's been happening in the past few months on American college campuses and thinking about what Graeber has said and conflicts that Graeber had with traditional, we might call them civil rights activists, has made me think there is a way to do this, and there's a way not to do it, and we need to think about it, and we need to figure out what that is, because one of the things I do believe in is democracy. This goes back to this Hobbesian thing. Whatever your protest is, it needs to make a difference and change the minds of many people, most people, large numbers of people. If your protests are aimed at, you know, convincing an elite group or your group that you are right, then they're not worth that much. And that's right. the kind of protest.
And actually, just talking about convincing people of things, there's something else I think it's important to say about Colin Ward on the 100th anniversary of his birth, is that unlike, you know, David Graeber, who was a kind of academic anthropologist and wrote his PhD on Madagascar and magic and that kind of stuff, Colin Ward was not an academic. He was not theoretical. He left school at 15. He was a social historian, but self-taught. And his writings are incredibly straightforward and simple and not really conceptual. He wasn't an inventor of new concepts. And I think, you know, he was very open about that. He always said, you know, I'm an anarchist propagandist. I'm just gathering the ideas which are around and finding ways to communicate them. And I think that's really important. I think we need all kinds of thinking in the world. But I think Colin realized that one of the problems with a lot of anarchist thought was that it just wasn't connecting with people. Both because it was too theoretical or it seemed not everyday enough. And his writings are, you know, I've never failed to understand one of his sentences. Whereas much as I like reading David Graeber, sometimes I just don't understand it, you know, but which is fine. That's one can struggle with ideas and things like that. And he's incredibly stimulating. But Colin Ward is straight down the line, straightforward. And he's coming from a different intellectual tradition, I would say.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I will just recommend again this book, Anarchy in Action. It is a pleasure to read. It is filled with relevant examples. It has also some sort of tragically ironic moments. Like I think it was written in 73, and he says, you know, with the women's liberation movement, we can see that the nuclear family depends on the subjugation of women, and therefore that will change soon. I read that. You know, I mean, I can't disagree with his conclusion that in 1973 it was clear that the nuclear
family depends. That's what it looked like. And I think that's the thing about Colin. I mean, one can read Anarchy in Action. I think it probably is the best way to get into his work. But there's also a really good collection published by AK Press called The Colin Ward Reader, Autonomy, Solidarity, Possibility. And that's another way into his thinking. And one other final thing I think worth recognizing, there's been a really good kind of intellectual biography of him written by Sophie Scott Brown in the last couple of years called Colin Ward and the Art of Everyday Anarchy. And she's really knows what she's talking about. It's really very, very fine book. And of course, people like Ruth Kinner, who's been on your podcast, who know a lot about Colin Ward as well. I mean, so I think he's been quietly influential on a lot of people, even though I don't quote him a lot in my writing. He's a kind of an invisible host. And there's this beautiful quote that he used to love, which showed his sort of humanistic side, which he found in a British newspaper, the Daily Mirror, in 1942. And I'd just love to read this briefly. Just a few lines. He read this in the newspaper, and this is what it said. 1942, so we're in the middle of the war here. Our children are guarded from diphtheria by what a Japanese and a German did. They are saved from smallpox by an Englishman's work. They are saved from rabies because of a Frenchman. From birth to death, they are surrounded by an invisible host, the spirits of men who never served a lesser loyalty than the welfare of mankind, or let's say humankind. And I think Colin himself is one of those kind of invisible hosts that's there, whose ideas are sort of going into our minds, even when we don't realize it. People now who are studying the child's view of the world, for example, Colin Ward has sort of been there, done that, and is worth going back to.
Yeah, and I have no doubt that Colin Ward's work was a major influence on the concepts of everyday anarchism. Even though I was deliberately not reading his books, he has influenced so many people. The ideas came to me anyway, and who knows whether I would have been reading people like Mumford and Getty. I mean, Getty's was an obscure one, was hard to find, and probably part of the reason why he is is in the ether is because of Colin Ward. Look, I've kept you a little longer than I meant to. That was a wonderful place to end, but I do have to ask if you've got anything else you would like to say before I let you go.
No, I think this has just been a kind of a taster of Colin Ward's books. And I just think that there's, and his ideas, and I think there are so many ways into his work. And it's a lot of it's really quirky. You know, the history of the British holiday camp, for example, he saw anarchy in action there. And I think the wonderful thing about him is that once you read his work, that everyday anarchist perspective, you cannot unsee it in the world around you. And if there's any legacy from him, I think it's that kind of legacy that it allows you to interpret an anarchist world in your own way, in your everyday life, to see it in the playground, at the swimming pool, at the community garden, in the farmer's market. And that, I think, is a gift to give us a new perspective, a new lens. So that would be my final word on the great and lovely and very important thinker, Colin Ward.
Wonderful. That is perfect. Thank you so much, Roman. This was such a pleasure.
It's a privilege and a pleasure for me. Thanks for the conversation.